Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Three guests today. Daniel Rajendra, director of a coalition taking on Amazon, talks about recent walkouts at that company's warehouses. Then the journalist Lauren Kaori Gurley reports on similar actions at Whole Foods and Instacart. And finally, the economist J.W. Mason looks back at World War II as a model for how to organize a Green New Deal, which is essential to getting out of the mess we're in and minimizing recurrences. And it is a mess. Over 6 million new applications for unemployment insurance last week, on top of over 3 million the week before. That's 10 million in just a couple of weeks. This is a massive economic crisis as well as a health crisis, and we're going to have to think in fresh ways about how to recover from it. Neither Donald Trump nor Joe Biden are the figures to lead such a transformation. First, Amazon. Like many employers, Amazon has been extremely lax about protecting its employees during the COVID-19 crisis, and some workers have had enough. There have been walkouts at several Amazon facilities around the country recently, with more likely to come. Here to talk about those is Daniel Rajendra, director of Athena, a coalition of almost 50 groups trying to humanize the retail monster. In the interview, Rajendra cites an op-ed by Jay Carney defending Amazon's practices. Carney, Amazon's chief PR officer, was Obama's press secretary for 3 years. It's striking how many Obama people have gone off to work for Silicon Valley. Rajendra also says yesterday several times. We recorded the interview on Tuesday, so that means Monday the 30th. Daniel Rajendra. Now, you work with the Athena Project. What's that all about?
I direct Athena. We're a coalition focused on removing Amazon as an impediment to a democracy that finally represents us all and an economy that works for people who are not named Jeff Bezos.
It works very well for him, clearly.
Yeah, I think he's all set. The rest of us might need something.
So what's the scope of your activity?
So we are 52 organizations of all kinds, local ones here in New York, as well as across the country, national networks like the Partnership for Working Families, Jobs with Justice, and the Center for Popular Democracy, think tanks like the Open Markets Institute, DEMOS, the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. But mostly we are community and worker organizing efforts focused on addressing the five of the most pressing harms that Amazon presents to working class communities.
And those are?
Those are working conditions, very much in the news now. So I think we'll talk more about that. I'll pass over that now. And then say we're focused very much on surveillance. We're the Amazon home of the No Tech for ICE campaign, looking to help Amazon see the light around eliminating its contracts with the immigration authorities, as well as organizing pushback against Ring, the video doorbell, one of the Amazon properties that has relationships with thousands of police departments across the country, exacerbating the existing over-policing crisis that working class communities, especially Black and Brown communities, experience. We work on what we call local fights, which is sort of the high cost of hosting Amazon in a community. That's public dollar subsidies that fuel its growth, gentrification, land use, water use, the whole gamut of conundrums that having Amazon in a community presents. We work on environmental and climate justice. Amazon is poisoning the air of the working class communities and communities of color that live around our nation's logistics clusters, in particular east of LA in Southern California and outside Chicago and Illinois, but all across the country. We also address Amazon's unsustainable climate impact. And last but not least, we advance anti-monopoly efforts because Amazon is too big, has too much power over politics and our economy, and monopolies are against the law.
Now, a lot of people like Amazon. It's very easy to use. You click a few things and the product shows up at your door the next day or two. How do you deal with that public that might not be too receptive to criticisms of the company?
Well, Amazon's a monopoly, so even if you don't have a Prime membership, as my household does, or click to order. We all rely on Amazon Web Services if you're using Zoom, like we are right now, or Slack, or Netflix.
Yeah, even some of the encrypted apps, too, like I believe Telegram or Signal.
Mm-hmm. lots and lots of online or digital tools run on Amazon Web Services. They are the 21st century railroad of contemporary commerce. And so we think that what we need are structural solutions to structural problems. And Amazon's a structural problem.
Are you working on Whole Foods stuff too, or just Amazon name brand?
So we are happy to work with anyone who works directly or indirectly for Amazon. The way we talk about it is anyone whose work makes the company function. That, of course, includes the warehouse workers, as well as drivers, delivery folks. It could include people that Amazon does labor brokering for, generally known as MTurks. It could include Whole Foods workers if they want to affiliate with us. We're always happy to have everyone who's working on the harms that Amazon causes.
Okay, so now Amazon is very much in the news these days because, for one, people have been using it very heavily because they don't want to leave the house. But for two, that comes at a very high cost to their workforce, who are being expected to work through sickness. One does not pledge to stay with one's employer in sickness and in health.
Indeed not.
What's going on with the workers that Amazon's exposing to great risk?
There's a number of things that are happening at Amazon that I think may be of interest to you and your listeners. The first is that Amazon is not being forthright with the people who work there or our communities or the public about the extent of coronavirus exposure and the risks that people are taking going to work. Yesterday, workers at the Amazon facility on Staten Island, known as JFK 8. Many of them walked out of work midday to protest the lack of information as well as the lack of safety precautions. We saw a similar effort in Chicago late last night. I think Amazon's giving workers no choice but to take dramatic action to protect their own health and the health of everyone they know and come into contact with. One worker who works at JFK 8, Phil Ruiz, has spoke to me a few weeks ago, and he's like, it's not just that I don't want to get coronavirus, he said, because of course he doesn't, but he said, I'm terrified about bringing it home to my block because it's these communities that lack sufficient access to healthcare, have disproportionate numbers of underlying vulnerabilities to coronavirus like diabetes and asthma and heart disease. And for them, exposure is potentially, as for everyone, is potentially deadly. And for what we're hearing from workers across the country is they feel intensely how we're all in it together. And Amazon lacks a comprehensive, adequate plan to address a public health and economic emergency.
Of course, Amazon says it's doing everything it can. It's scrubbing down and taking all the necessary precautions. I presume that's not really true.
Well, that's not what workers report. Last week in Kentucky, the governor shut down a facility that was processing customer apparel returns. I think it was mostly sneakers. And we think more governors should be like Governor Beshear, who is looking carefully at the public health impacts of everyone's operations, including Amazon's, and shutting down those unnecessary and non-essential operations to protect public health of the workers. Of course, worker health is public health, and of the communities in which workers reside.
I'm curious what kind of organizing has led to these walkouts, which from a distance look spontaneous, but I don't think there are many spontaneous things in life. So what's been going on behind the scenes?
On Staten Island, prominent New York organizations like Make the Road New York and New York Communities for Change have been in conversation with workers there for months and months. There is a strong network of people who are focused on not just the warehouses, but throughout the operations. People need a lot of protections. Long before the corona crisis made clear so many of the underlying problems of our society, there were national news reports and local news reports about the outrageous rates of injury inside Amazon facilities, not just in the warehouses, but also for people who are delivering packages. So we've been in close communication. Longstanding organizations like the National Employment Law Project and others have been instrumental in ensuring that worker health and safety concerns come to light even before we face this pandemic that makes it clear that we're only as healthy as the most vulnerable around us.
Bezos, of course, is famous for thinking that the customer comes first, and I imagine that takes a very significant toll on the workers. I mean, even before we entered this crisis, it was a place of, as you mentioned with the injury rate, it's an intense speed-up and scrutiny of the workforce. It's really a brutal labor discipline, isn't it?
Taking into account the fundamental human needs of the people whose work makes Amazon function has never been a hallmark of Jeff Bezos' leadership.
polite way of putting it.
And I think that what this crisis shows is that the people with the skills and talents to amass enormous fortunes, Jeff Bezos' fortune is so large, we need TikTok videos full of rice bags to help us visualize exactly how much money it is that he has, right? The skills and talents necessary to amass enormous fortunes are perhaps not the skills and talents we most need at a time of public crisis. Amazon is expertly engineered to make a lot of money for a very few number of people. It's not designed, in fact, to protect customer health, public health, or our social needs. And this is a moment, the combination of the health crisis, the pandemic, and the economic crisis is a time that requires public leadership from people with a better set of skills.
Yeah, and just parenthetically, I have a friend who was a programmer at Amazon briefly, and he said that even programmers are treated brutally. It's not just, you know, line workers making barely above minimum. It's people with PhDs who are supposedly, you know, highly valued and an expert. Even they are treated brutally by this company.
You know, Jay Carney had an op-ed in the Times not that long ago, but it does feel sort of like a million years ago, and he was saying we're doing what lawmakers and others, folks, ask us to do. We have directly hired our warehouse workers instead of subcontracting them, which is true. They do that. They pay above minimum wage. It's true. They do that. The labor arrangements, employment arrangements for people at inside the warehouses is different than inside the distribution centers, is different than inside the delivery facilities and the ways in which the package arrives at your door. They have created a false dichotomy between the customer and the worker. This moment makes it clear that actually together, customers, workers, small business sellers, neighbors, we're really all in this together. We rely on one another. The cost of delivering packages at such low prices comes at everybody's expense, not only workers, perhaps most importantly workers, since they're the ones bearing the brunt of this exposure crisis, but certainly not only workers, we're really all in this together.
And finally, what do you expect Amazon customers? I mean, there's some enormous proportion of the United States population has a Prime account.
Yeah, more than one in two American families.
Yeah, so what should we do? Should we stop buying from Amazon or what?
Well, the first thing that everyone can do is sign up to join our fight at athenaforall.org. We're going to have a whole host of things that we ask folks to do in solidarity with Chris Smalls, who was fired by Amazon after speaking out yesterday, and the worker efforts we expect to continue. Amazon can't scare us. We're sticking with one another. It's important to understand that Amazon solves real problems for real people. People really do need delivery. And long before many of us were sheltering in place, people who were homebound for their own reasons, people whose local economy was trashed by Walmart and then Walmart closed up. Like, there are many reasons that people rely on Amazon, but Amazon is not meeting those needs out of the generosity or the goodness of their own heart. They are cannibalizing a whole host of failing social systems. And we at Athena think of ourselves as one part of a multi-pronged effort. So while we're focused on extracting better paid leave and more transparency from Amazon in this moment of corona pandemic, and we invite everyone to join that effort, our effort right now is about pressuring states, especially governors, to intervene as Kentucky Governor Beshear did in looking closely at Amazon operations and ensuring that only the most essential operations are happening so that we can prevent as many exposures and flatten the curve, not just for middle-class folks, but for everyone. Those are some things we can do, but it's going to take all of us.
But you're not calling for a boycott of Amazon.
It's very difficult to have a boycott of a monopoly. The cash cow for Amazon is Amazon Web Services, which undergirds so much of the way in which we're communicating now. The best way to express solidarity is directly with the workers and in supporting the organizing to build enough power to appropriately regulate and ensure public oversight over the corporation. And while I certainly encourage everyone who can to support local and community business rather than buying things through Amazon, there are just so many people without another option, and that's why we need structural solutions via our democracy.
That was Daniel Rajendra, director of Athena, a coalition of almost 50 groups taking on Amazon. You can find them on the web at athenaforall.org. That's athenaforall.org. As I was putting this show together, Amazon announced that it was taking steps to improve worker protections. We'll see how serious they are. And now a report on worker rebellions at Whole Foods, an Amazon subsidiary, and Instacart, an app that sends people to shop for groceries for you. As with Amazon, the bosses are treating their workers with extreme disregard. Here's Lauren Kaori Gurley, a reporter with Vice's Motherboard, with more. How has Whole Foods been treating its workers throughout this? Imagine not with great generosity.
No, not with great generosity at all. They have offered to provide anyone who gets sick and has a positive coronavirus test with 2 weeks of paid leave, and they've raised their $15 minimum wage to $17 an hour. But there are a lot of problems with this. A lot of people have gotten sick at Whole Foods around the country at this point. They've had people test positive at a ton of different locations in New York City, in California, in Chicago, in Florida. And their response has been to shut the stores down for maybe 3 hours or 2 hours and then just open them up the next day. And in a lot of cases, workers said that they have either heard through the grapevine that someone tested positive, or they've heard from a manager or something. And then several days later, the company will leave them a voicemail or something and say, hey, like, someone tested positive at your location, and give like sort of an official message to all the employees. But this is 3 days after they found out about what had happened. So obviously workers are going to be scared that they had been exposed to something in that time frame. Whole Foods isn't giving workers any sort of heads up as soon as they find out, and they're not shutting down stores. They're just doing a deep clean. And, you know, the way that this is passed is mostly through human-to-human contact, not through people touching different objects and items. And so they're not really resolving the situation by shutting down the store for a few hours and doing a deep clean. Like, the same people are going to show up to work the same day. I think the other issue is that people will go to work sick if they're not offered sick pay. If they have to pay their rent, they're going to show up to work sick because they don't have any other choice. So I think I've also spoken to a lot of Whole Foods workers who say, yeah, everyone's going to work sick. There's no other option, really.
And I'm guessing they don't really have any health benefits to speak of.
Whole Foods workers do have health care. Full-timers do have health care. Whole Foods scrapped health care benefits for part-time workers back in December. But people don't feel like this is sufficient, I guess, to deal with coronavirus in particular, because it's nearly impossible to get a coronavirus test. I spoke to a number of workers who said, hey, I had all the symptoms of coronavirus. I got a doctor's note. I told Whole Foods, and they said, sorry, we're not going to give you paid time off because you need to provide us with a positive test result.
You have to be half dead to get a test.
Exactly right. Yeah. So no one, you have to be famous or half dead or something like that to get a test.
But are they also worried about endangering their customers?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I think that's a big concern. One of the demands that they made this week is that they want some sort of social distancing policy in place. I don't know if you've been in the Whole Foods recently. I guess I haven't, but I've heard that there's just, like, you know, big lines of people standing, like, normally, like, a foot apart from each other. Workers are showing up to work sick. They're touching, you know, cashiers are touching all of the produce. They are very worried about their customers. I think this whole thing that's going on now, not just at Whole Foods, but, you know, at Amazon and for other gig workers, is that, yeah, this is something that affects not just the workers. It affects customers. It affects the workers' families. It affects entire communities. So it's a little bit different in that way from traditional labor actions, I would say, in that the impact is really direct on other people here.
I meant, was the company worried about that? Because, you know, I would imagine, you know, if this sort of negligence is revealed, they're going to get their asses sued like crazy.
Right. I guess Amazon, which owns Whole Foods, doesn't seem particularly concerned about that. They're saying they're following, at least when I've spoken with their spokespeople, it's like, we're following whatever CDC guidelines or, you know, whatever health officials are telling us, but they don't seem to be super concerned about having like a mass outbreak in a store. That's a good question. A lot of people are relying very heavily on Amazon right now and sort of Whole Foods and other grocery store chains. And so I think a lot of these companies are making record profits, and they don't really see an incentive to slow down.
Groceries are one of the few businesses that are just, I guess, booming right now because everything else is shut, but people are just, you know, stocking up like crazy and hoarding. From a purely economic point of view, you could understand why management would want to keep the doors open, but they're putting so many people at risk by doing this. So, like, what kind of reaction are we getting from the workers now, the organizing that's going on? What kind of actions have there been?
So, at Whole Foods, there was a sick-out organized yesterday, which was Tuesday. It's hard to figure out how many people, get a good gauge of how many people are participating in these things. Obviously, Whole Foods is like no one participated in it. And the workers are like, yeah, there are people at all different stores across the country who participated. I think what was tricky about, or clever at the same time, about the Whole Foods sick out was that Whole Foods just changed its policy so that people aren't penalized for calling out sick. They can stay home from work and they won't get paid, but right now they're safe to call out from work sick. So yesterday, if a bunch of people called out of work sick, which they did, it wasn't obvious to Whole Foods necessarily who was participating in the protest and who was just feeling sick that day. I think a lot of Whole Foods workers have told me that their stores are just pretty much down to like bare skeleton crews right now because people do not want to go to work at all. If they have any savings in their bank account, they're probably going to stay home because the risks are so big.
Who is organizing this? Is this spontaneous, self-organized, but outside organizers? What's happening?
The Whole Foods strike, well, all of these actions mainly are not, you know, the workers aren't unionized. And so they're actually coming out of these groups online that have formed not just workers from a single store, but across the country. For example, with Whole Foods, it actually isn't online. It's an encrypted app called Telegram. That's sort of like Signal, if anyone's heard of that. Workers, there are hundreds of workers in this Telegram group, which is an app that you can download on your phone that's encrypted, and they organize the entire sick out through that. It's just like a chat room where workers don't have to use their real names, so there's some privacy there.
And ironically, I believe those apps run on Amazon cloud service.
Yeah.
Instacart is a different story. Instacart is not a subsidiary of one of the largest corporations in the world and not run by the richest guy on earth. What kind of company is Instacart? Are these just like gig workers with no formal employment relationship?
Yeah, so Instacart is, I believe, now the largest grocery delivery app in the country. It's based in San Francisco. It's been valued at like $8 billion. They have a workforce of nearly 200,000 gig workers. And then they have another set of actual employees who work at grocery stores. That's about 12,000 workers. They're mostly gig workers, but then there's a contingent of employees. They are a little bit different. They've sort of seen the same trajectory as Uber and Lyft drivers, where there was like a bait and switch model where they were making a bunch of money when the apps first started out, and over the years they've seen their wages precipitously drop. And so they've been organizing for a while. There's a group of Instacart workers, organizers who are based in San Jose area in California, who have created this Facebook group, this national Instacart Facebook group that has thousands and thousands of members. And they've organized a bunch of what I guess would be wildcat strikes over the years, including in November that got a ton of visibility, and they've been asking for changes in the tipping model for a long time because I think people know that a lot of these apps sort of steal or take tips away or tinker around with how the tips work. They've been organizing for a while, and when this whole pandemic came up, they found themselves sort of at the center of, they are the frontline workers. They're, as the CEO mentioned the other day, the app has never seen sales like this, like it has over the past few weeks. And Instacart announced last week that they were going to add an additional 300,000 gig workers to their workforce over the next 3 months. And that's a lot of people. And, you know, workers are obviously upset about that. It's similar with Uber and Lyft, where the more you flood the market with workers, the more wages go down and there's more competition for good gigs.
In the current environment, there are going to be so many people desperate for any kind of work that they can just pay them whatever they want to.
Right. People make like pretty pitiful wages. A very complicated order can come out where you have to drive, especially if you're in a suburban area, 10 miles can end up being worth like $8 or something like that, whereas before it was worth a lot more. So they organized a strike on Monday, and they were asking for $5 hazard pay for each order that they do, an additional $5 of hazard pay. They were asking for basic safety precautions like hand sanitizer and disinfectant, which they don't get because they're gig workers. And then they were also asking for paid sick leave that extends beyond just testing positive for coronavirus. It's the same thing that everyone's asking for. Everyone can't get tested, and so they just want a blanket, comprehensive paid sick leave policy that includes people who are immunocompromised. And, you know, if you're a gig worker and you're immunocompromised, you're just not working at all right now, which means you have no income at all. You have no benefits or protections. So, yeah, those were the main demands. I think they look a lot like what other people are demanding, other types of workers are demanding right now, a set of demands that seems sort of universal right now.
And these also are pretty much self-organized through social media and apps, as with the Whole Foods?
Right. They're on this Facebook group that has 15,000 people in it. The way that these Facebook groups work, with a lot of gig workers, the company will create a Facebook group for workers that's like pro company, and you're not allowed to talk bad about the company on there. And then over the years, people who've gotten frustrated with, you know, wages dropping and stuff will create alternative Facebook groups that have gained a lot of sway. Like this Instacart one has, like I said, over 10,000 workers in it. And a lot of the organizing goes on there, and it's people all across the country. One other thing I would add is that what was unique about this strike on Monday, Instacart, was that it wasn't just the gig workers who were involved. There were also Instacart employees who work in stores who also walked out. And it was sort of the first example of a coordinated action between the two of them. Instacart employees have also been organizing. A group of them unionized in Chicago early this year for the first time ever. It's interesting to see organizing going on across different workforces that haven't necessarily seen their interests as the same before.
And then finally, what do you see in the horizon coming up? Any other activities of this sort?
Oh, yeah. A lot of these organizers are calling for a general strike, right? How general strikes sort of start off is a bunch of people going on unauthorized wildcat strikes at the same time. But beyond that, more specifically, I know that workers at Target and at Trader Joe's are thinking about organizing things. There's probably going to be a strike at Target at some point of a similar nature, an unauthorized strike. So I would keep an eye on those things. I think that there's a lot of momentum at Amazon warehouses to, you know, stage big walkouts. We saw three in the past 2 days, I think. We've seen one in Staten Island, one in Chicago, and then today one in Detroit. And so I think that's going to keep happening.
I was Lauren Kaori Gurley, a reporter with Vice's Motherboard. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
Thank you.
That was some of Krzysztof Penderecki's Threnody for the Victims of Hiroshima, with the composer conducting the Polish Radio National Symphony Orchestra. Penderecki, a giant of 20th century music, died on March 29th, not of the coronavirus. But his music seems appropriate at the moment. Next, finding economic models for a Green New Deal in the World War II mobilization, a lesson in economic planning on a very large scale. J.W. Mason, an assistant professor of economics at John Jay College, City University of New York, is co-author, along with Andrew Bossi, of a paper published by the Roosevelt Institute on the topic. Some people are uncomfortable with using the war mobilization rather than the New Deal itself as a precedent for the Green New Deal, and I understand that. Humane interventions are more inspiring than war. But there's a lot to be learned from World War II if we're contemplating major economic transformations, an entire history of planning on a very large scale has been mostly forgotten. Here's J.W. Mason with more. Getting out of this economic mess we're in brings back memories of the New Deal. Of course, we've got the New Deal on the Green New Deal on the table already politically. Are there some precedents in the World War II mobilization that would enable us both to find our way to economic recovery, but also preserve life on the planet? Is there some historical lesson here?
Yeah, I think arguably the World War II period is a better model than the New Deal, in the sense certainly for if we're thinking about a Green New Deal, because the New Deal wasn't systematically an effort to reorganize the economy. It was obviously an effort to revive economic activity. And there were various agendas about supporting labor and redistributing income, but there wasn't a sort of systematic vision of a different kind of production, a different set of economic activities that were supposed to come out of the other end of this thing. And with World War II, obviously, there's a very rapid and systematic effort to reshape production in new directions. And so I think, arguably, that's actually a better model for decarbonization in some ways.
And the Roosevelt administration was initially reluctant to have such a large role for the public sector, right? They were kind of forced into it.
Yeah, that's one of the most interesting things to me in reading about this, because I think there's sort of a myth, and people sometimes say, oh, well, you know, you could do this during World War II because there's this upsurge of patriotic feeling and everybody realized that, you know, the government had to take the lead. But that's not true at all. There was enormous resistance both within and outside the administration to having a central public role in the war mobilization effort. And at this point, I think the New Deal is kind of on its last legs. And decision makers in the Roosevelt administration really initially had the vision that we're going to put out contracts for military equipment, and then the private sector will just figure out how to fulfill those and what level of investment they need to get the capacity, and that the public sector is not going to have to play a central role in that at all. That was, I think, explicitly the expectation, and they really only shifted towards a much larger public role when it just turned out to be impossible to get the level of production they needed on that basis.
What made it impossible? Did we have the industrial structure and it was just a matter of ramping it up, or did we not have the right industrial structure?
Well, I think there were a combination of problems. In some cases, you really needed new industries that simply didn't exist. And the sort of outstanding case here is synthetic rubber. All the natural rubber, you know, supplies are basically at this time in Southeast Asia, in areas that were quickly occupied by Japan. And so there's no natural rubber available. And so there's the need to create a synthetic rubber industry. You know, people had been experimenting with synthetic rubber in the 20s, but there was no commercial synthetic rubber industry whatsoever. You had to build this thing completely from the ground up. And the same goes basically for aircraft. Obviously, there was a commercial aircraft industry, but it wasn't anywhere close to the scale that was needed and wasn't producing the types of planes that were needed. So these industries really had to be just built from the ground up. In other sectors, the structure was there. You can obviously shift an auto plant to making tanks fairly easily. Steel is steel. But you still needed to increase capacity very rapidly. And the interesting thing is that even though, you know, the war contracts, they weren't necessarily super profitable, but they were certainly reliably profitable. And yet private industry was just absolutely unwilling to take any risks associated with increasing capacity. It was very clear businesses did not want to build any new plant or acquire new equipment for this purpose, and banks didn't want to lend for it.
Did they believe that it was just too short-term, the contracts would just dry up and they'd be the left holding the bag?
That was definitely a fear, because that did happen to some extent after World War I, that there was, once the war was over, the mobilization was just wound down immediately, and a lot of businesses that had ramped up capacity to support the war effort found themselves, as you say, holding the bag. So a big fear was the uncertainty about how long the war would last. But there's also the uncertainty about what the post-war world is going to look like. Macroeconomic conditions. Are you going to go back to a depression, obviously, as many people feared? And then for the newer industries, like synthetic rubber or aircraft, it's not clear, even in a booming economy, how much demand there is for their output. And so this is a lot of risk. And one thing I think we know, and one thing you go back and you read Keynes and a lot of the critics of sort of orthodox economics in that school, the private sector is actually quite bad at bearing risk. There's intense aversion to making long-term irreversible investments without a very high degree of certainty about the income that they're going to generate. And in the war effort, the private sector just did not feel that certainty. That's where there's a strong analogy to decarbonization, because we know in a general way that we absolutely have to do this. We have to shift completely off of carbon for electricity, for transportation, and so on. But we don't necessarily have a very clear idea today what the costs and what the demand for specific pieces of this are going to look like in 10 or 20 years. We don't know what the electricity market is going to look like. And so there is a lot of really fundamental uncertainty, a lot of risk that businesses is not necessarily going to be willing to take on during that investment.
This takes us back to that Keynes and Knight distinction between risk and uncertainty, that risk is kind of normal, quantifiable, in some sense mathematically probabilistic, but then uncertainty is so deeply radical we just don't have any idea. I mean, is this the issue is really managing that kind of deep radical uncertainty?
Absolutely. You know, the war and, again, I would say climate change are really outstanding examples of fundamental uncertainty where you really just can't even assign probabilities to the different outcomes, and that makes the sort of normal financial strategies for managing risk really, really not viable.
And then the role of government then is to stabilize those expectations and provide some kind of foundation that then allows the private sector to make the investments it wouldn't otherwise.
Right, to do that, but also in some cases for the public sector to make the investments itself. Well, we use the language of bearing risk in this paper, which Keynes or a proper Keynesian would be a little unhappy with, because, as you say, there's a distinction between uncertainty and risk. But for the public sector, where there really is just not the possibility of calculating returns in any meaningful way, the public sector just has to step in and make those investments. Because the truth is, in many cases, I think you can assess the sort of technical qualities of a project more easily than its financial qualities. That you can assess much more easily, you know, how much capacity of installed solar or wind power you need to replace our current fossil fuel than exactly how profitable that's going to be, because there's a whole additional level of variables that comes in there. You know, or the same thing in the wartime, you know, they were very effective at ramping up aircraft production, and there was a whole level of physical planning we don't talk about much in this paper, but was very important, where key input steel, aluminum, rubber were just allocated centrally from D.C. And they really did have a good system for predicting exactly what the demand and availability of these different resources would be on that level. But again, making the long-term forecasts of what the returns would be for people who invested in producing this stuff, it just involves a whole other level of challenge that is much more difficult. And I think in those cases, it's just much easier for the public sector to step in and say, we're going to solve the technical problem and not worry about what the financial returns are going to be.
Yeah, how much planning went on at that really macro level, like kind of input-output levels? You know, you need steel to make airplanes, you need rubber to make airplanes, glass, and all kinds of things. How did they work out all those details of making sure that the supply chains all work together and you could get airplanes rolling off the assembly line at the end of it all?
I mean, all this stuff was improvised during the war, and that's another clear lesson. There's a lot of experimentation. And early in the war, as I said, there was an effort to really try to rely on just standard private sector mechanisms. You put out the contract and let the contractor worry about the inputs. And that was not working. You had bottlenecks, you had shortages, you had crazy price swings. Even a big run-up in the prices for some key input didn't actually stimulate investment there, and certainly not in the sort of coordinated way that you needed. Rubber, steel, aluminum, oil, they really were centrally allocated by the Oil Production Board sort of through the war. Other stuff came in and out of that. But they really did. For those four, it really was a question of the input-output kind of tables, where you say, here's how much is being produced on this schedule, and here's the industries that need it, and here's how we're going to, you know, allocate it among those industries. There was really no market for those key inputs at all during the war.
And they're really just kind of figuring this out as they went along. There were no models or blueprints they were using?
That's right. That's right. And there were a lot of debates about this early in the war, which are sort of interesting. You know, the feasibility dispute where the military just wanted to ramp up production, you know, kind of overnight. And a lot of the leading economists were very skeptical about this. And it's a little bit complicated because on the one hand, the economists, you know, Kuznets and others were skeptical that the U.S. economy could produce as much more as production increased during the war. And production increased a lot during the war. One thing everybody expected at the start of the war is you're going to have steep cutbacks in civilian consumption. And that really didn't happen. Civilian consumption actually rose throughout the war. I think it dropped between 1942 and 43 very slightly, but the overall trend during the war was strongly upward. So civilian consumption kept rising, which nobody expected. The capacity of the U.S. economy to increase its level of production in response to this huge increase in demand was much greater than anybody, including any of the leading economists, believed. On the other hand, what Kuznets and other folks also said is if you're going to have this scale of military production, you actually need a planning process. You're going to hit all kinds of shortages and bottlenecks. You can't just put out these huge orders for planes and tanks and the rest of it without actually having a plan for where the the inputs are going to come from. And so that was sort of the positive contribution of the economists in that debate, is that you needed an explicit planning process.
I'm speaking with the economist J.W. Mason.
Now, you would think this kind of ramping up demand would be inflationary, and there was much less inflation than one might have expected in the war. There was a burst of inflation in the years after the war, but during the war, not so much. How did they control that?
Price controls and rationing really worked. You know, John Kenneth Galbraith was the head of the Office of Price Administration, running the price controls for the government, and by and large, the price controls were effective. People talk about rationing during the war, which there was, but the important thing to realize about rationing is how you deal with a situation where people's incomes are rising very rapidly, but you don't want to have a surge of inflation. You limit the amount they can buy. It had nothing to do with scarcity, which is sometimes how people imagine it. But the other thing, I think, and this to me is an interesting economic lesson of the war, we have this idea of inflation as just being when the economy is running over capacity. But another view, which is, you know, was very much Galbraith's view during the war, is that inflation is often about specific shortages, specific bottlenecks, and ramping down demand across the board, you know, raising unemployment, lowering demand across the board doesn't actually help. What you need to do in the short run is actually explicitly limit those price increases so they don't feed through into everything else, and then obviously allocate those goods in a different way since you're not using prices in the short run. And in the long run, you actually deal with those bottlenecks. You increase output, production capacity in those specific areas. Galbraith was very clear that it would be a terrible mistake to try to deal with inflation by limiting overall demand. And I think he was right, and I think there's an important, you know, lesson for us today in that, too.
Now, you mentioned rising incomes. There was a substantial compression of incomes, and black workers especially did much better as a result of the very tight labor markets the war created, right?
Yeah, for the U.S., as for most of the world, you know, the decade of the 40s sees by far the largest compression of income that we can identify historically. And, you know, people used to talk about that, you know, when Piketty and others talked about this, they say, oh, because, you know, all the capital was destroyed, so capital income went away. That's silly. It's silly in general. That's not really how capital works, but it's definitely silly for the United States. There was, you know, obviously this vast expansion of physical capital. There was a huge redistribution of income, and because wages rose a lot, and wages rose very much in the lowest paid industries at the start of the war. It's actually quite a remarkably tight relationship. The lower the wages are at the start of the war, the more they increase during the war. And the interesting thing is there was no policy effort on that at all. I mean, they did, the Roosevelt administration did support unionization mainly because they didn't want war production disrupted by strikes, but they did support it. But there was no systematic effort to have no kind of wage policy or even much in the way of labor market policy. So this increase in wages at the bottom was really just all about tight labor markets. It was all about the greater bargaining power of people at the bottom of the distribution. And the interesting thing is that really sustained itself after the war. And then, as you say, for black workers, too, there were huge gains. By far, the biggest closing of the gap for median black versus median white workers. But that was almost all about the overall compression of incomes. If you're at the bottom of the distribution and the distribution, you know, compresses, you get closer to the middle without actually moving within the distribution. And for the most part, that's what happened during the war. For black workers sort of at the top, there was an improvement, a movement within the distribution. There were more black workers moving into skilled jobs and a lot of black workers moving into manufacturing, which they, you know, had been quite underrepresented in before the war. But that was a smaller piece of it and only really affected the top part of the distribution for black workers. The biggest thing was just that overall compression, which, you know, I think we really underestimate how powerful those sort of super tight labor markets can be.
A lot of the war was financed by borrowing, big increase in federal debt during those years, but there are also some increase in taxes as well. How significant were those? How progressive did the tax system get during that period?
Well, I think this is where the lesson is maybe less positive and more cautionary, because, you know, when you're raising taxes, you really have three different goals that you're sort of weighing against each other. And this was, you know, again, an explicit debate during the war period. On some level, you want to just finance government expenditure. The money going out, you want to balance it by money coming in. And for a lot of reasons, you don't want it to be just money from new borrowing coming in, you want some taxes to do that. So that's financing government spending is one. Rating and inflation is two. And people were very conscious of taxes as an inflation control tool during the war. And then three is, of course, redistributing income. And all of these, you know, goals were articulated during the war. But in practice, the goal of redistribution really was not effectively pursued. The tax income tax structure became less progressive. The income tax structure was at the start of the war was extremely progressive. Only the top tiny fraction of households paid any significant income tax. The tax base was broadened quite a lot during the war. And that, you know, that was simply because there was, if you think about it, a tax that's effective at reining in inflation is a tax that targets consumption, which means a tax that's relatively flat or even regressive. So the taxes that are effective for inflation control are not generally going to be the taxes that are effective for income redistribution. And in practice, during the war, the focus was not on redistribution. The top fraction of the over 100,000, which is a tiny group of people in this period, paid a third of the income taxes in 1938, but only 12% at the end of the war.
Okay, so the income tax became more of a mass phenomenon as a result of the war. Okay, so now let's take this forward to the present and the future. We would like to see some elements of a Green New Deal invoked as a response to the present crisis. You know, we're going to see a massive increase in unemployment. It's going to be really, really hard to get the economy started again after this virus passes, assuming it will. What lessons do you see from this World War II experience for a Green New Deal, both in the short term, just to get out of this problem, but in the longer term, to restructure things?
Well, number one is that we really cannot put, if we're talking about a rapid and comprehensive reorganization of the economy, a shift in activity from one sector to another, changes in technology, all that stuff, we can't do it through the price mechanism. Carbon price, maybe that's part of it, but it's not going to be the central part. And I think people are realizing that. We need a much more direct government role in carrying out the investment itself, and where you have private investment sort of directing credit or subsidies to particular sectors. A price mechanism is not an effective tool for this. I think that's lesson one. You know, lesson two is we should be optimistic about the ability to decarbonize while preserving existing living standards, that there's a lot of slack in the economy almost all the time and a lot of space for a big investment program to actually raise incomes today. And I think that's politically really critical, because I think if people perceive decarbonization as something that requires more austerity and sacrifice today, the politics become overwhelmingly difficult. So I think it's really important to realize that if there's less of the war experience, it's not that. You can have guns and butter, or you can have, you know, solar panels and butter. And then I think the third lesson is that if we can really do this on the scale we need to do it anyway, that's going to have big direct benefits for people at the bottom of the distribution. Just mobilizing the economy on the scale we need to decarbonize rapidly by itself is already going to have a huge boost for wages of low-income people, for African-American workers, for women. Doesn't mean that we should be talking about a just transition. We should be talking about stuff that's specific to those groups. But I think that maybe we underestimate just the importance of full employment for delivering a more egalitarian economy.
Now, an awful lot of environmentalism comes with a free hair shirt. I mean, it seems like they're we need to eat less, move less, consume less. You're saying that isn't necessarily true.
I think it's not true. Obviously, certain categories of consumption, maybe we'll have less of, maybe we'll eat less meat, maybe we'll have less air travel. But I really think we have to get away from the frame that says we are going to have to get by with less. Our lives are going to get worse in the short run to protect the planet. Maybe morally, we should be willing to make that trade. But we don't have to, and we shouldn't frame it that way. You know, I think we should be thinking about, you know, all the new forms of consumption that actually can expand we can have much better housing that, you know, is part of making our housing less wasteful. We can also make it better. We can have much more available mass transit. You know, this is the key thing. You know, if you're going to impose a carbon tax on people to make you know, driving a car more expensive, it's not enough. Some people say, oh, we'll rebate the tax. And no, you need to provide real positive alternatives. You need high quality free transit everywhere. And you need all sorts of collective consumption. We have to imagine a world where we're using far less carbon, but we're living better. We're living better in material terms. I think that's absolutely critical. I think that the hair shirt approach is just, I think it's wrong. I think it's substantively wrong, but I also think it's politically self-defeating.
The lesson of all this is that if we want to recover from this mess, but also to rework our economy so it supports life on Earth over the longer term, we can't rely on markets, and we need a very aggressive public sector role of the sort that we haven't seen since the 1940s.
That's right. That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. The thing that makes me optimistic is where we started, which is that people didn't come into the war with this idea. They discovered that they needed it, and then they adapted. And I think now maybe we're beginning to start down that road with the coronavirus.
We just would need a different set of personnel at the top of the government, though.
Yes, yes. One catch.
Did the experience of the New Deal make it politically easier to sell this kind of a bigger role for the federal government? I know you said that there was a reluctance going into the war, but was it somewhat easier than it would be after 40 years of neoliberalism?
I think it was. I think it was. Obviously, you had certain individuals, like Galbraith or Harry Hopkins or whoever, who were there, who were already in the administration, who were ready to take on this role when they had the opportunity. That's absolutely right. And you had a broader kind of culture that accepted a leading role for the government and that accepted some idea of solidarity and collective project. I don't know. To me, it's very hard to assess how important that was, but certainly you're right. It is a difference between that time and today.
I was J.W. Mason, an assistant professor of economics at John Jay College, City University of New York. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this. More from Penderecki's Threnody, performed by the Polish Radio National Symphony Orchestra with the composer, who died a few days ago, conducting. Till next week. Bye.